This is bound to give you nightmares.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you
fire.
I'll take you to burn.
I just love, like, the keyboards.
Fire.
I'll take you to burn.
Fire. I'll take you to burn. Michael, we're going live in 10 seconds.
We are?
10.
But Hobbo, I'm burning for you.
5 seconds.
Standing by, Hobbs.
3, 2.
I'm the god of hellfire!
I'll take you to burn. We're live. Roll your damn window down.
Politics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Gremium Bunker, welcome again, I'm Micah Hanks. You've locked into the one and only Gremium Report. Glad to be with you as always. Tonight we've got quite an interesting program lined up for you. In addition to examining some mysteries of the world and a little bit of what I'll be doing in the coming week during my never-ending travels of the world, we'll also be looking back in time to the presence of a possible conspiracy that was erupting in the Southwest, elements of which we have certainly discussed in the past on this program. And it has to do with what one man calls the Empire of the Wheel. That's right, he's a former FBI informant. Walter Bosley will be joining us to discuss this. And we'll be looking at everything from ritual murders that may have been taking place to a group of what we might call friends from Sonora, which, of course, has a lot to do with this ongoing investigation that many researchers have had a long-held interest in that involves the possibility that there were airships aloft during the 18, maybe as far back as the 1850s, but at very least throughout the 19th century. A lot to cover tonight, looking forward to getting into all of that. And as we look ahead, speaking of things seen in the sky that, well, unfortunately, eventually do come down, following Newtonian physics, at very least, the continuing search for flight MH370 has had yet another possible clue emerge over the last few days, as claims of debris sighted in the Philippines now have Malaysian investigators interested. But there are a few problems with this, because first of all, no photographic evidence of this has surfaced. And there are some rather strange things about this claim, as we'll see in a moment. Now, here's what we know according to the International Business Times. Malaysian officials are investigating reports that a plane crash site was spotted in the southern Philippines on Saturday. This was initially reported by News Asia. Jamil Omar, 46, said his relative had spotted plane wreckage with a Malaysian flag inside, and this was on the island of Tawi-Tawi. Now, authorities, of course, have called on the public not to speculate on the claimed sighting until officials are able to carry out an investigation, since past reports of debris sightings have, for the most part, been inaccurate. Interesting that, of course, they have to ask people, please don't speculate about this. And there was more, as I'd mentioned, about this particular report that seems rather strange. Mark Brady, of course, the eminent Gremium newsie, who sends me a plethora of links on not just a weekly but a daily basis, along with Lindsay Morris and Jan Fitzgerald and a number of others out there. We appreciate you guys who send along news. But Mark had pointed out there's one aspect of this that seems fishy, doesn't it? And I have to agree that there was a claim that skeletal remains were seen inside the wreckage just as well. So it seems rather unusual to me that a Malaysian flag was seen inside and the claim of skeletal remains. I guess we'll have to see what happens, but right now police are investigating the report. Of course, it's the ongoing continuation of an international search that had been initially led by Australia, which remains underway, and it covers around 46,332 miles or so in the South Indian Ocean. Still looking for answers as it relates to that. Of other things seen in the sky, yeah, the Telegraph and Argus in the UK reports that UFO researchers and campaigners from across the world are going to be converging on the region this weekend for a conference organized by a Cayley man, and that is none other than Mr. Anthony Beckett, who's putting on the 7th Annual British Exopolitics Expo, being held in Leeds. Now, they report that delegates are attending from as far afield as Australia and the U.S., and that the event at the Leeds Beckett University on Saturday and Sunday will feature a series of lectures and discussions. Now, among the speakers, we'll have Pierre Sabak and Andrew Johnson, who'll be examining claims of a secret space program. And, of course, among those speakers will be none other than yours truly, Micah Hanks, Richard Dolan, whose program follows this one. Richie's going to be there just as well. Longtime friend and fellow researcher Mike Cleland is going to be there, and also UK-based Robbie Graham. I mean, a lot of us are going to be in that neighborhood this coming weekend. I fly out on Wednesday. It's going to be a long and arduous trip, of course, overseas, as they always are, and then a bit of jet lag to follow. And then I'll be giving my lecture Sunday, which is actually going to touch a little bit on what we're going to be talking about later in the program with Walter, which is one reason I wanted to try and get him on, and he was gracious enough with his extremely busy schedule right now to work us in. Because there is an element, I think, as far as UFO research, especially that of yesteryear, goes, that I do think fits into this. And I guess to preface the later conversation, I'll just say this much right now. When you look at UFO research, you know, I prefer to look at this as being a study of things seen in the sky. Now, I know that sounds like a no-brainer, but think about this. Since the eruption onto the public consciousness of UFOs in 1947, Kenneth Arnold sees this fleet of objects traveling over Mount Rainier, Washington. The following month, of course, we had the claims that the U.S. Air Force had captured a flying saucer on a New Mexico ranch. We have all of this myth and conspiracy and you know, intrigue that surrounds those early years, and a lot of possibilities and potentials afforded us. I mean, on the far out extreme, we have the notion that extraterrestrial alien beings from space are coming to Earth and they're keeping an eye on what we're doing, especially after they notice a couple of little A-bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And of course, with the continuation of those tests, you know, we start launching nuclear weapons into space, you know, off of Johnston Atoll with Operation Starfish Prime. No, that's not a member of the Transformers, by the way. Look that up. But the point is that there have been many, Stanton Friedman and others over the years, who have, even during interviews I've had with them, have speculated that, yeah, we were literally putting up a great big cosmic flare, and we get everybody's attention when we enter the nuclear age, and they want to keep an eye on what the monkeys down here on Earth are doing. But that's just one interpretation, and I think that, you know, when I was younger and more naive, frankly, I wasn't just open to that possibility. I didn't see beyond that as being the reality of the UFO phenomena. But what we have to recognize is that there are a lot of different tiers of understanding that could be applied to unraveling the mystery. And funny though it is, since we're going to be talking about some rather controversial statements made by our commander-in-chief here in the U.S., President Barack Obama, here in a moment, I'm reminded of something that he said during a Democratic debate back in 2008. And there, of course, because of the interest among some of the Democrat candidates, namely Dennis Kucinich, but others just as well, as it relates to the UFO subject, the question of alien life actually came up during one of the debates. And I remember Barack Obama being asked whether he believed that alien life existed someplace out there. And although he was somewhat tongue-in-cheek with his response, I think he actually made a very good point. He said, look, you know, I don't know if there's life out there, but I know that life exists here on Earth. And I've always said that beyond that, you know, whether it's intelligent life on Earth, that's still questionable. But I think he's right at very least in so much as the idea that there is life here on Earth. That much we seem to know. And when we apply that to the notion of what may be going on out there in the sphere of what we call UFO research, I think that we have to take into consideration a few conditions of probability. Now, many would say, look, UFOs are the evidence we've been looking for of extraterrestrial life, and yet scientists, our astronomers, our physicists, you know, they say, listen, we have not found convincing evidence of life elsewhere. And when they start talking about things like digging around in the Martian topsoil and finding liquid water that may be conducive to life, A lot of people are sitting here laughing, going, come on, really, guys? But to me, that illustrates one of two things. On the unlikely side of things, that there is, as many assert, a broad-reaching conspiracy to withhold information from the public, since, after all, as Jack Nicholson said famously, we can't handle the truth, right? And therefore, that's why the extraterrestrial reality is kept from us. Maybe there's some truth to that. Who knows? But that cannot be proven at this time based on the data and the information before me. And many in the past who have said that, look, it's obvious, here it is, we can prove it, have failed to convince the scientific community. We also have to recognize, while we're talking about the likelihood or unlikelihood of a conspiracy, of course, that there has long been, and we can't deny this, there has long been an element aimed at dissuading the public from believing in not just the alien component, but the UFO component in general. This coming from a guy who generally strays away from the extraterrestrial hypothesis as it relates to UFOs, and I'll get into that a little more in a minute. But I just want to be very clear that I don't deny, and I'm well aware of, and frankly I find it very disconcerting, the level of obfuscation that has been present in UFO studies over the years, namely that of Edward U. Condon and the University of Colorado UFO Project. In my book, The UFO Singularity, I talked about the Lowe Memorandum, and it was clear that these guys from the outset were going to try and present a good argument against the UFO reality. But what I think is interesting is that we can say that there are objects seen in the sky, and we can detach ourselves from belief or conjecture, leave speculation at the door for a moment, and say that there are things probably that are seen in the sky, and in fact, a number of the reports contained within the Condon Committee report itself actually remain unexplained. They couldn't explain all of them, and they didn't necessarily discount the possibility that there could be unexplainables. But many, of course, in UFO circles, and rightly so, look at this period in history as being the so-called end of any credibility that the mainstream was willing, whether it be academia or the media or anything else, the very end of credibility for the UFO subject, and it therefore was relegated to the fringe circles. But what I want to try and illustrate here is that when you look at this dichotomy between the academic mindset about this subject and then, of course, those who are the advocates, what we find is that there, like a lot of things that appear to be mysterious in our culture and in the sphere of possible existence here on Earth or elsewhere, for that matter, we find that UFOs kind of fall into that area where there is this extreme polarization. And it's interesting because that mirrors politics, that mirrors religion, just anything, basically, that you want to say. If it's a contentious issue, there are going to be usually two sides and sometimes many more than that, which says a lot more about human nature to me and the nature of human attitudes and belief. It's very natural for us to become polarized and offer differing perspectives, and therefore the skeptics become extremely hardened skeptics, and the believers often gravitate toward the extremes, trying to bring it back to the middle. I look at that idea, and I don't necessarily credit Barack Obama with some wonderful, statement about UFOs, but I'm just using his statement anecdotally to reflect a broader sentiment. We do know that life exists on Earth, yeah? And if we have been unsuccessful in completing a survey of the possibility that life exists elsewhere that convinces the scientific community of that reality, perhaps we should also look at the UFO phenomena within the confines of Earth life and thus Earth technology. Now, that seems extremely implausible. While we're talking about the implausible, or at very least what seems highly unlikely, let's look at other possibilities. Time travelers. This is something that people have talked about. We've played the audio here on the program before of debate between the likes of Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan about time travel may not be non-existent, it just may not be recognized today as time travel. We may be seeing things like ghosts or UFOs, and this paraphrasing what Sagan had to say about the subject, and that these things we may recognize as paranormal phenomena today, they could be evidence of some technology from the future. That's another concept I explored in my book, The UFO Singularity. What I find troubling is that after an extensive review of how time travel may actually exist and how it may actually work within the confines of our universe, according to general relativity espoused by Albert Einstein, what we find is that time travel, although not impossible, and it actually is a recurring element that takes many forms in our examination of relativity and the way that the universe works and the way our laws of physics work. Time travel is not just a little quirk that appears one time. There are actually several theories about how it might be enacted, but it's extremely difficult to achieve. And so I don't necessarily set that notion aside, but I look at the general theory underlying time travel, which we've discussed in the past on this program, and that is the idea that black holes, or technology that could create similar functions within the universe, strangelets, which could be expanded using anti or negative energy, and thus be transformed into wormholes that might be utilized for bridging boundaries between two points in space, and thus possibly time just as well, we begin seeing that there are other applications for dimensional travel. And it was Einstein's theories of relativity that in the early years of UFO studies, according to scientists, made it unlikely that aliens from some distant galaxy were traveling here, because at very least they'd said that even traveling nearing the speed of light, it would take them 4 or 5 years to get here and then to travel back, and therefore it's not just a hop, skip, and a jump away. But again, that's assuming that they're traveling across a space covering that entire space and not warping space and time, which seems like a possibility. And whether or not time travel is possible, similar physical principles might apply, but that's still considering that there's some alien technology underlying the UFO phenomena. And with the constraints applied by the physical universe, and any physicist knows this, and this in part is due or the reason behind their skepticism about the alien component underlying UFOs, it might not be so impossible for advanced and unconventional varieties of aviation to have emerged over the years in various circumstances, which utilize laws of physics that, of course, are absolutely existent, but which are widely unknown. Now, that seems, again, to many to be highly implausible. Oh, nobody here on Earth, first of all, if it were governments, you know, somebody would have to be able to find a paper trail. If it weren't the government, who would have that kind of funding? And this is where that notion of the breakaway civilization, or, again, what some of the lecturers this weekend in Leeds we'll be talking about, including Andrew Johnson, the idea of a secret space program. I've got friends in the space program who say, look, we've never found any evidence of anything that suggests a secret space program. However unlikely that seems, however, I will say this. With the lack of evidence we have conclusively that points to extraterrestrial life visiting Earth, the notion that someone or some organizations, perhaps more than one, here on Earth could be behind, if not all, a majority of what we constitute or what we would identify as the UFO phenomena, it has to seem more likely, because we don't have to go to the great lengths of trying to prove that life exists here on Earth. The hardened skeptic will try and discount all UFO claims. People do not see advanced aircraft. People are liars. People are hoaxers. People are always trying to get something out of it. The human mind is incredibly fallible, and the ability to remember is almost non-existent when a person becomes excited. And yes, there is some truth to that, but I don't buy those general arguments against UFO witnesses. And frankly, I find that the members of law enforcement, military, trained pilots, and people who give very vivid, clear descriptions with multiple witness encounters where they have observed these craft at various times throughout the last half century or better, and frankly, going back even further if we want to look at a broader examination of the literature, it seems clear that people are not necessarily crazy. They're simply observing phenomena or technologies for which they do not have a proper comparison based on known technologies existing on Earth today. We have to be open-minded. And in being open-minded, we don't discount possibilities like the ET hypothesis. But what we have to do is we have to remember that being open-minded does not mean becoming beholden to sacred cows. And this is the problem I find with UFO research. And it gets a lot of people angry. It ruffles feathers. But from time to time, we need that. A person who proclaims to be very open-minded but will not see any possible source behind UFO technologies, we'll say, other than ETs visiting Earth, space brothers engaged in genetic hybridization and warning us and sometimes protecting us from ourselves, people who are unable to or unwilling to see beyond that single possibility are not truly being open-minded. They are giving themselves to belief in only one other alternative, which is really no better than what hardened skeptics tend to do. If we want to be open-minded, and this is why I've often said I'm open-minded but skeptical, I am skeptical of what seems unlikely or improbable. But as we know, looking at mathematics, improbable things happen every day. So we can't rule out the improbable. We can only try to apply a philosophical logic to the situation and try to understand what seems most likely given the criteria before us. And being open-minded means allowing for different possibilities based on the likelihood of those possibilities. And hence, to me, the notion that technologies existent here on Earth, however obscure and strange though it may be that they have been kept from the general public and even government institutions, that is perhaps a more likely possibility, in my mind, than the ET hypothesis. But as many have said, Richard Dolan, Catherine Austin Fitz, and a number of others, it could be a combination of different things. And I, of course, in one of my earlier books, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, looked at non-technological ways that people over the centuries have attempted to communicate with other intelligences. There very well may be, in the grand scheme of the universe, a lot of different ways that contact may occur between various intelligences, human and non-human, and perhaps non-physical. There are probably a lot of different levels and tiers and modalities through which this can occur. That's something, again, I'm very open-minded to, and while those things do not meet the rigors of scientific exploration, there are a lot of scientists over the years who have also discussed where their inspiration came from, and sometimes it borders on the esoteric or the downright metaphysical. We just have to take into consideration those kinds of things, and therefore, again, looking at the UFO phenomena, there could be a combination of different factors, and then, of course, on the lower end of things, just natural phenomena that often are lumped in with the purported quote-unquote UFO technologies, which in fact are not technology at all, but are merely natural phenomena, which we don't fully understand. So we go over all of these kind of things, and this weekend in Leeds, we're going to be going over a lot of these things just as well at the Leeds Beckett University. If you are in the UK and you're interested in this subject, you know, I recommend strongly that you come down. I know that Mike and I will be speaking on Sunday. I think Robbie Graham is going to be talking right after me that same day. Richard Dolan will be speaking on Saturday. It's a lot that's going to be crammed into a couple of days. And I will be focusing not on the secret space program idea so much as the notion of a breakaway civilization and a truly strange case that involves purported technologies in South America. I always end up coming back to South America when it comes to this subject because of not only the different reports that have come out of various regions over the years that involve people observing strange things and secretive technologies, but also, in truth, the interest with regard to the Nazis headed to South America after the end of the Second World War. Ronald Richter, of course, the Austrian scientist who had worked under the Reich, but then following that, of course, he went to work for Juan Perón and was investigated at one point. He was found to be mad, and there was very little attributed to the plausibility of what he claimed he was doing. But he wasn't at one time he was investigated by the U.S. Air Force because he had been saying he was working on a new kind of physics that would be applied to aviation technologies in very unconventional ways. And I'll leave you with this before we head back to the news, that when you look back at those early reports, 1947 and 48, there were a lot of people describing these great big rocket-like things, you know, two-leveled with two rows of windows. So imagine like a two-story craft of some sort. You know, the Charles Whitted encounter was one of these really seriously strange ones. Even astronomer J. Allen Hynek, later one of the staunchest UFO advocates, had said he thought that that was in likelihood a meteor. But what's important to remember about that case is that Hynek made that determination before he really started looking at the data and saying, okay, look, maybe there is more to this than meets the eye. Furthermore, what the Charles and Whitted encounter entailed, the object, and if you're unfamiliar with that, Google it. Do look that up. It is remarkably similar to something that was seen by Captain Jack Puckett in August of 1946, if memory serves, and he had been flying to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida in the early morning hours, and he and his crew observed virtually the exact same sort of an aircraft. There was one that was seen days before pilots Charles and Whitted had their encounter over Holland, I believe. And this aircraft has been seen in other localities over the years just as well. A long, almost like a B-17 bomber fuselage, minus the wings, but roughly double the size, with flames shooting out the back and illuminated windows down the side. And Project Sign, when they investigated this, this is part of what moved them to investigate, was this determination about, okay, if they observed an aircraft, Charles put it, and not merely a meteor streaking through the sky, what could account for this kind of technology? It was both a exciting time in the history of aviation, speculation about it, and of course also at times an unsettling period. And it's one that we revisit fairly often here on this program. And therefore, those of you in the UK, again, if you're going to be in the area of Leeds, we'd love to see you there at the British Exopolitics Expo. I'll be certainly not the only one who's going to be lending a bit of skepticism toward certain memes present in the UFO literature, but nonetheless looking at what I think are a lot of plausible connections to Earth technologies that may help unravel aspects of the mystery. I'll be talking about that and really looking forward to meeting a few of you while we're there. Speaking of Britain, by the way, the Daily Mail, it's always interesting when you get U.S. news from a British source. Sometimes there's a little less filter applied, you know, and having a conversation with my parents the other night, I dropped in to visit them, and we were talking about just some of the garbage that you see on the 24-hour news cycle here in the United States. Not to say that it doesn't happen elsewhere, but, you know, my dad was just complaining and saying, you know, back in the old days, you had ABC, you had NBC, you had people who were real newsmen, Walter Cronkite, you know, people like this, Edward R. Murrow, men who actually presented the news, not people who were trying to be polarizing and put a spin narrative, you know, on things that they give. And I'm sorry, that's all the news channels. I mean, whether you watch Fox, MSNBC, Headline News, even CNN, which is supposedly more balanced, I mean, you're going to get a spin no matter where you go. And here's why. Because we're not just looking at news stations anymore. What we're looking at is corporate news. What we're looking at is a ratings-based presentation of, yes, newsworthy items. But, you know, you'll hear guys like Adam Curry and John Dvorak talk about native advertising on their podcast. If you don't follow No Agenda, I very seldom have time to listen. But when I do, it's really a great, it's a very entertaining show. I don't agree with everything that they say, but I think that in large part, their assessment of the way that BS is fed down the line to us via mainstream news is pretty spot on. You know, when you hear these news anchors reporting about, you know, what's happening at McDonald's this weekend, the new McGriddle, that's not news. No, it's not news. And there's a reason why that is featured as news. Yeah, because these are corporate entities that are presenting mostly news, but other things just as well, which include a political agenda, often. I'm sorry, no, always. And which also, of course, feature sponsorships that appear in a variety of different ways. So that said, it happens across the board and everywhere. And this is one reason I like new media like podcasts, blogs, and independent providers of news. I mean, this is an important thing that we have to have, and it's always interesting when you can find a way to get a little bit of interesting perspective on things. And so the Daily Mail carried this story today that really caught my attention, because I'm going to tell you right now, it's very in line with what a lot of conspiracy theorists are saying as we're heading into an election year here in the U.S. When we come back from this break, we'll look at exactly what was said in the Daily Mail, what it has to do with American politics, and why it may have certain conspiracy theorists concerned. I'm not personally concerned, but who knows? Things can change. And rather quickly just as well. We'll change for the break right now and come back right after this here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. Now, during the last segment, I was mentioning that there was something I wanted to discuss very briefly. Didn't have time to get to it before the break. But an item that appeared in the Daily Mail in the UK, and the headline reads as follows. Obama says Trump won't succeed him and believes that, yes, he could win a third term. What? Now, going to the website, I actually find that there's a little more to that headline. He could win a third term if he were allowed to run again. But you know, among conspiracy theories in the United States, I've had so many people come up to me. My buddy Dan the other night, in fact, we were catching up and having a beverage and talking. He says, man, I tell you, I'm worried. I think Obama's going to try and run again. And I'm thinking, well, that probably in likelihood is not going to happen. Although, let's just be honest, there is some historical precedent for this, a president actually being elected to three terms. FDR did it, but then again, that was also due in large part to his popularity as a wartime president. But I guess, again, it's not impossible. But that's not what this article is even talking about. Obama essentially is saying he, first of all, doesn't think that Trump is going to be a successor to him, but he certainly says that if he were allowed to run again, he thinks that he could be elected. And this is what he said about Donald Trump. He says, I think he's a great publicity seeker, and at a time when the Republican Party hasn't really figured out what it's for as opposed to what it's against. And of course, he says that he feels that Trump, in his waging war against immigration, has tapped into a legitimately concerning element within the voting public. And maybe there's some truth to that just as well. And while he was described as being, quote, visibly irritated about the way that this entire Hillary Clinton email scandal thing has played out, he also says that despite it being a mistake, that he feels it's all been ginned up because of politics. And I think that she'd be the first to acknowledge that maybe she could have handled the original decision better and the disclosures more quickly. Wherever you stand on things like that, that's beside the point, but it's interesting, again, just kind of coming back to what I was saying in the last segment, you get a international perspective on U.S. politics, and one that nonetheless, to an extent, kind of plays on the concerns of people, especially the more conspiracy-minded. And that specifically, of course, is the idea that, well, you know what? It could be a power grab. We may have Obama for three terms. And so without politicizing the discussion, again, this is something that, interestingly, I find a lot of people talking about. You really do. And people ask me every day, they're like, who are you going to vote for? And I say, I have no idea. And the reason why is because it's way too early to even make a decision. I mean, you know, the political parties, the presiding parties, haven't flipped a coin. They haven't met in a darkened room someplace yet, flipped a coin and decided which team's going to win and who they're going to put forward as being the credible winner and loser. You hear all kinds of stories. Let me just say that when you work in media, I used to produce talk radio programs. I had an opportunity to speak very candidly on a number of occasions with different representatives of North Carolina and other states, and we have had interesting conversations over the years. These representatives, one in particular, wouldn't want me giving out their names publicly, but you know, we've talked about everything from whether or not 9/11 was an inside job to whether or not the political parties really are playing games and that the game is rigged, so to speak, mirroring the statements of George Carlin. I love that. The game is rigged. And I agree to an extent that really it is. I wish I could say that in truth I could tell you that there is a real political process and that as individuals we have a lasting effect on that through our participation in elections and whatnot. But it seems more and more with time that that is less and less truly the case. And so maybe when we see these kinds of concerns among people, oh, you know what, President Obama could be elected to a third term, despite the fact that there are constraints on his ability to do that. You know, a two-term period, and that's it. Well, again, there have been situations in the past, as we have seen, where there is historical precedent, perhaps, for that concern. And interestingly, the Daily Mail, being outside the United States with this headline, yes, he could win a third term if he were allowed to run again. I mean, they explicitly state that in the headline, but where it appeared on the Google News feed didn't have that last part. And it's very interesting because to me, to an extent, obviously, this is, of course, this phenomena of clickbaiting in the way that, to an extent, media does this. They sensationalize, they hype things to get you to click those links. But there's also a very concerted effort to play off of the fears of the public, and they tap into things that people are concerned about, whether or not those concerns are warranted. And this is what really kind of drives the news cycle. And when I mentioned in the last segment that I'd dropped in to speak with my parents and we were complaining about the way that the news cycles are today, the overt politicization, the spin, you know, I brought to the table, and this sounds kooky and crazy to a lot of people, but there are people within the industry who will say, look, you know, the U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA especially, I mean, they are very, very concertedly involved in the way that media is presented And anybody who thinks otherwise, you can call it a conspiracy theory, but this is in the best interest of national security, according to these agencies. And it's just the reality. And the propaganda machine presented by these mainstream news agencies, it's exactly what they're trying to do. They're not really reporting the news. It's a corporatized, news-like entity that is spinning the narrative in such a way that presents a propagandized element to the public, hoping that they'll digest it. One more reason, as I've always said on this program, for as long as I've been doing this program, the Graylian Report, we've been going since maybe middle of 2010 or maybe early 2011 with this show. And although generally what we focus on this program is science and the unexplained, from time to time when it relates to that discussion and also to the ideas of secrecy and conspiracism and themes that we do discuss and analyze from time to time on the show just as well, I will bring up those subjects. For the duration of this program, and as long as I've been doing it, and therefore also every other show I've done in between, when we were doing the Micah Hanks program as a standalone radio show here on KGRA, the Middle Theory show that I did with Mr. McNonymous until his decision to depart from the program, and future programs, of course, that are right now presently in the works, and I'm kind of hoping to get some of my fall travel out of the way before we get to that. But for the duration of all of the aforementioned, I have not, in my home, owned a television. I have not had cable hooked up. I've had the company, you know, telling me that, you know, you could actually save money if you just get our nice three-tier bundle. We'll get you high-speed internet and a phone line, and we'll just hook you up with television. And I'm like, that's okay. I'll pay $10 a month more. I do not want to have that. I don't want to have access. I don't want to have the temptation. I'm doing just fine with Netflix. But just to give you an idea of what I mean by the way that media can utilize propaganda in a way that is in the interest of national security, there's something that I read that was kind of inferred in a book that Joseph Farrell wrote. I think the book may have been Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops. And there are times where Joseph Farrell, again, you got to keep in mind, he is Oxford-trained, but his background is actually in patristics, you know, study of the writing of the saints. But he's a guy who's a lot like me. His interest is history, and actually it's multifaceted, his interest, but there's a lot of discussion of history. But Joe also really digs into science, and he even told me once that, you know, again, you know, I spend most of my time reading obscure books that have to do with science and history, physics and things like this, and they just fascinate me. I like it when an academic doesn't become beholden to a single viewpoint or area of specialization. And I know that eventually, with my continuing education, if I'm ever able to obtain my PhD, I may become a doctor of, you know, something like history or philosophy, but, you know, science will be a large part of what I do just as well. Joseph Farrell is very much of like mind, and hence the variety of things that he writes about. So in Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, I believe that was the book where he talked about this unusual New York Times article that appeared in maybe 1948 or 49. Now think about this for a moment. What was described was a flying saucer hovering over the Thames River in London. And the story goes that the observers who saw this, and this would have occurred during the wartime era, this would have occurred toward the end of the Second World War, but the observers said that this saucer bore the Iron Cross on it of the German Air Force. And so when they're looking at this, they're saying, quite obviously, this seems to have been a Nazi flying saucer. But Farrell points out that this report, despite being backdated, so to speak, to the war years, didn't appear in print in the New York Times until after 1947, when the saucer craze had already become the meme in the public mind that it had, that, of course, you know, that for many years it would continue to be, in fact. So the point is a lot of people would say, you know, it's a pretty credible, you know, source for a flying saucer report, you know, the New York Times, and especially if they're describing the Iron Cross insignia on this thing, then hell, I mean, it must have been a Nazi saucer. But let's think a little more deeply about what that would potentially mean, especially, you know, with Annie Jacobson's new book that Nick Ressler right here on the network was kind enough to send me a copy of, Operation Paperclip. You know, we know that Nazi scientists like Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth came back over to Huntsville, Alabama, and worked with our space program. Hermann Oberth Well, Von Braun just as well, but Oberth especially, they took a very serious interest in UFOs and even wrote about that subject a good bit and spoke about it. Oberth was known to have attended UFO conferences back in the day. So these people were just as interested in this phenomena as you or I. Now, Farrell, of course, has, I think, kind of scrutinized Oberth's discussion of UFOs and his claims of really not knowing what's going on. I think that Farrell has, in his writing, tried to make a case, and maybe there is a case to be made. But again, you know, what his focus has been is that Oberth seemed to have been involved in some projects, and one of these may have been this Die Glocke thing, this Nazi bell. But that's neither here nor there. Point is that there was an interest espoused by these people. And the point that Farrell had made was that the fact that this article appeared in the New York Times when it did, describing what it did, rather than to be taken as a literal retelling of an observation of a Nazi flying saucer, here we have these reports of what's being seen over the Americas. Kenneth Arnold saying that he's seen these things. All of a sudden, all sorts of things are being seen in the sky. A lot of them obviously do involve, you know, the U-2, Oxcart programs and whatnot, high altitude, at the time, experimental jet aircraft and various other things. Weather balloons, yes, sometimes would qualify as well. No matter what was seen, you go back and read the reports from the 50s and 60s, as I've done, and actually as I cover in detail in my book, The Ghost Rockets, no matter what was seen, it was described as being a flying saucer, because this was the term that the media had assigned to aerial phenomena following Kenneth Arnold's initial observation. I mean, that's just the truth. And if there was some unknown phenomena in the skies, or at very least the perception of some unknown phenomena, or perhaps a combination of both, the U.S. military was actively involved in investigating this. The U.S. Air Force, later with the institution of Project Blue Book, of course, would spend years trying to unravel the possible truth behind the UFO phenomena. I don't think the entire thing was necessarily just a cover for secret aviation technologies that our own government was working on. That could have been a part of it. But I think that there was a legitimate interest in some pretty far-out technologies, the likes of the Chiles and Whitted thing that we talked about in the last segment. What Jack Puckett saw. You know, what others, numerous others, have seen and continued to see over the years. At one time, there was a legitimate interest in trying to see what these things were and trying to explain and account for the technologies being observed. But in the midst of concern over what they may be, with little doubt, U.S. intelligence agencies felt that they could exploit this. And one great way to exploit this, knowing that, for instance, the Russians are going to be examining what is reported in U.S. newspapers and the like, is to make up a story, to make up a tale about a flying saucer, which without any question can be attributed to the Germans by virtue of the Iron Cross appearing on the object in question. We put this story in no less venerable a news source than the New York Times, knowing full well that this is going to communicate to the Russians, okay, the U.S. is abuzz with these stories of flying saucers, and here we see that there was one of these things with a German symbol seen toward the end of the war. Well, what are they to deduce from this? Oh, of course, that these technologies were captured by or from the Germans and brought back to the United States, and now they're testing their own versions. And it gives the impression that we are carrying a bigger stick than we actually have. In other words, the intelligence community in likelihood probably exploited the idea of flying saucers to an extent. And Joseph Farrell and others have inferred this from these kinds of reports that appear. Which would explain, of course, later on, in the truer sense of journalism, sad though it may be, why the flying saucer discussion is almost invariably downplayed. The only reason I could assume that so stark an example of a flying saucer, one that seems apparently so seemingly related to the Nazi component toward the end of the war, the only reason I could think for that to appear in an article in the New York Times or anyplace else would be for purposes of propaganda, for purpose of sending a message to the enemy that leads them to think that we have more working behind the scenes than we actually do. I don't think that's implausible. But, you know, when we're talking about the broader elements involving control of the media, it is done in a number of ways for a number of reasons, and it has continued to occur over the years for such reasons. And I don't think that we can deny that there is a level of control that occurs in the media. And so when people say it's kooky and it's conspiracy, you know, and you're talking about flying saucers and Nazis and all this kind of crazy stuff and everything, and that the intelligence agencies like the CIA control the media, people think that's silly. But when we look at these counterintelligence programs from over the years, the scenario I'm outlining here, and I'm not the only one to have done it, I mean, it does not seem unlikely. And so I would ask you this, weighing the alternatives. Yeah, I'm sure that there have been what have been classified variously over the years, flying saucers that have been observed. It's not beyond the scope of the imagination to think that intelligence agencies around the world might exploit those sightings to their advantage and use the mainstream media to do that. We'll pick things up right there when we return here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Some rather spacey sounds you're hearing right there. The John Stickley Trio. A remarkable group. I'm blessed enough to be able to perform with this incredible guitarist you're hearing right here. That is John Stickley from time to time, along with the lovely lady, Lindsay Pruitt, on violin. They just had their new CD release party here in Asheville Tuesday night. Regretfully, I was unable to attend, but I was actually one of the sponsors behind their Kickstarter to get this off the ground, and I'm extremely happy to hear what they're doing here. You can check them out online, johnstickley.com. That's J-O-N, Stickley, with an E-Y on the end, .com. Check out the John Stickley Trio. Great stuff. I'm sure we'll be hearing some more. And John explicitly told me, he said this would be great music, I think, for your podcast. Hey, John, I agree. Very spacey stuff. That tune you're hearing right there is Darth Radar. Well, he was right. It would be perfect, wouldn't it? Now, that said, moving on to the news here, there's a bit of an update that has appeared via the website crimefeed.com in one of those famous cases, and one which we have focused on in the past on this program. The family of two bank robbers who escaped from San Francisco's notorious Alcatraz prison back in June 1962 have come forward with what some consider a bombshell. They claim the men didn't drown after fleeing. In fact, Clarence and John Anglin's relatives are saying the former prisoners might still be alive today, more than 50 years later. Apparently, to flee the prison, the brothers, you know, along with another inmate, Frank Morris, shimmied through a hole they'd chiseled into the walls of Alcatraz Prison and climbed up to the roof, as portrayed in that famous Clint Eastwood film Escape from Alcatraz. Officials claimed that the three inmates drowned upon fleeing the prison, but their bodies, it's true, was never found. And now, a new television special will be airing, in which the Anglin brothers' nephews offer what they say is evidence that the men survived at least until the mid-1970s, but may still be kicking today. They reportedly didn't come forward with the leads until recently because the FBI harassed the family for many years. Alcatraz officials were not willing to say, quote, maybe the escapees did make it, David Widener said, according to news.com.au, which reported on the story. That gave me the motive to prove them wrong. Now, interestingly, there is a card, for instance, that was reportedly sent by one of the brothers to Mom, signed Clarence and John. This Christmas card sent post-escape. In fact, they say that there are a couple of these that are both signed by Clarence and John that were delivered to their mother annually for the first few years after their escape. The escapees' nephews also reportedly came forward with a photograph of the brothers, plus other evidence just as well. They believe the brothers might have ended up living in Brazil. If they're still alive, they'd be in their 80s today. It's interesting. It always goes back to South America, doesn't it? It always does. Whether it be Nazis escaping after the war, you know, outposts of the breakaway civilization, or the brothers who escaped from Alcatraz. But on that note, and kind of leading into what we're going to be discussing in the next hour. You know, something that has long fascinated me is a case which some say there's absolutely nothing to it. Isla Friendship, which is essentially an island off the coast of Chile that was purportedly called Friendship. The story about Friendship Island is a weird one. I wrote about it a number of years ago for Mysterious Universe, a rather lengthy article talking about this. And the story went that back around 1984, someplace near the southern coast of Chile, this mysterious distress signal had come across a ham radio. Octavio Ortiz was a business agent who operated a little 27 megacycle CB radio station. In his pastime, he claimed that he started getting these messages. Now, there was a captain of a ship that was purportedly called the Mitaluz 2 that had been sending these strange messages that Ortiz intercepted, which pertained to an object in the sky that it had been following, or perhaps that was being followed by. Mitaluz 2 was tasked under the Department of Oceanography by the University of Chile and had been in an approach for the Mitalog Lighthouse when a strange bright object appeared in the sky and then slowly began to descend toward it. By the time Ortiz had come across the messages from Alberto, his contact there, this strange object was now hovering directly over the distressed captain's ship. And the story is a really weird one that spins off in a number of different directions, but the gist of it is this, that there was supposedly, in addition to the observation of these aerial phenomena, that there was also this island, Friendship, where these gringos, as they were described by the locals, existed, and that they had very little to do with anyone else in the area, very little to do with the comings and goings and the happenings of the everyday worldwide, but that they had this incredible advanced technology out there on this island with them. And it's long been discredited because after numerous searches for the so-called Friendship Island, nothing really has conclusively been offered to suggest that there is indeed an actual island out there or that such operations were taking place there. The Magonia blog wrote a pretty comprehensive article about it, debunking the entire thing and calling it Fantasy Island. But Scott Corrales of the Institute of Hispanic Ufology, he moderates a really good blog, and I think it's the most important blog probably that relates to UFO research in the Latin American world, and it's called Inexplicata. And if you haven't read it, you can check it out at inexplicata.blogspot.com. But there was an article that Corrales featured that actually contained a number of correspondences from over the years that involve very similar retellings from people in Chile and people who have family members there that seem to kind of fit into this idea of everything from the Friendship Island, who was on the island, who was operating, what the gringo operation out there actually involved, and even elements of local folklore. One that really mystifies me that has to do with a spirit vessel or a ghost ship of sorts that is part of the Chilote culture there in that region. But anyway, I just want to share a little of this. And Scott Corrales at his blog had written, one of the most perplexing cases to ever come out of Latin America in recent decades has been that known of the Friendship case. And I want to point out, by the way, that it's not to be confused with the similar Italian case from a couple of decades beforehand, although I'll note that it's strange that the same name, Friendship, is offered here. Now, Scott continues to say, a mixture of encounters, audio recordings, and sightings of strange characters, largely human in appearance, who claim to belong to the Friendship, identified by some as space aliens, by others, Nazi survivalists, and then even Protestant missionaries from North America by others. Well, Scott writes, we have presented articles on Friendship since the 1990s when Josep Guijarro visited the Chile area and kindly allowed us to translate his findings for the Inexplicata journal. Today, thanks to our friends at the NOUFA organization, we share with our readers the latest information in the form of a series of letters and essays on this compelling subject. And a few of them are rather interesting. One from a gentleman named Antonio Bellacanto, 35-year-old researcher, and he says, I've spent 6 years looking for the Isla Friendship and looking into the affair. It's a very long and complex subject, but I'd like to tell you everything I know because I believe I've discovered what's going on there. My duty as a researcher is to make that known. He talks about a particular television program that aired back, I believe, in 1998 about this. And he talks about the ongoing search for the truth behind the Friendship Island circumstance. He says, my friends, this is the summary of what happened in 1998 on the television program. My investigation enumerates the discoveries made in recent times of Friendship. He says, first, the Chilean Navy is concealing the information. The fact is that there are no extraterrestrials or anything like that living on the island, only normal people. It's his belief, Belicanto, that the United States is behind the entire thing. Friendship, he says, is something like a branch of Area 51. In 1973, 3 months before the coup d'etat against President Allende, two islands in southern Chile were sold. Their names were Isla Huapai and Friendship. There's a religion behind all this that will go unnamed. Now, that's an interesting point, isn't it? He says, at the time of the coup, President Nixon gave Chile money to organize the attack on La Moneda, which was Allende's presidential residence. The American strategy was to have Allende killed because he knew about the sale of these islands. These conclusions cannot be found on the internet or in libraries. That's what Belicanto said. Here's another letter that was received that Corrales features at his blog. He says, my name is Zolia Centeno Rubio, age 65. I'm a Chilean national living in the Spanish city of Toledo for over 25 years. Now, I'd like you to know that in the year 1954, my father was transferred to an inward island in the sea facing the coasts of Valdivia. My father suffered from angina pectoris due to his heavy use of tobacco. He smoked nearly 3 packs of unfiltered cigarettes a day and was transferred there by a family of German origin whose farm equipment my father had repaired on one occasion. These Germans were very industrious, hard-working people, but also mysterious. They took part in none of the celebrations of the surrounding Chileans and spoke among themselves in their own language. My father was a very smart man and very skilled with his hands, as well as gifted with the ability to learn languages. So it was that over the years he managed to pick up German rather well. Upon returning from that island, which he described as small but with strange machinery he was unable to describe, he said he had been treated in a very impersonal manner and was not able to endear himself to the people who took care of him, but noticed that they concentrated greatly on what they did, since after 3 days of being subjected to a laying on of hands and some small metallic plates placed on his torso by rather elderly gentlemen, he noticed a significant lightening of his chest as far as what they did. And that's a really strange story again. He says he returned aboard a very modern vessel and only saw one of his neighbors, the oldest among them, who informed him that they'd made an exception in his case and they thought him to be a person of pure feelings, devoted to nature and his family, but told him to never smoke again. Given that his German employers were very reserved and only spoke of agricultural matters, he tried to forget about the subject, repaying them with his work and the same discretion. My father died thinking that something wasn't right about the place where he was taken. He remembered nothing about the days he spent there and noticed a series of quote-unquote doctors. He said they looked almost more like angelic figures than local residents, and he never suffered again due to tobacco, but died later wondering about the strange experience he'd undergone. A lot of these stories, there's a book that was published a few years ago that disclosed purported sequestering or the acquisition of a bunker-like island in southern Chile by, yeah, that's right, the Nazis. There's a historian living, he's actually Chilean, Victor Farias. He lives in Germany now, though, and he states that in 1939, prestigious national politicians received payment from the Nazis for an island in southern Chile, where a secret submarine base, it was said, was going to be built. And the stories just go on, but it's a truly perplexing and almost bottomless pit. Many say that there's absolutely nothing to any of it, but others say, you know, it seems like there certainly was something going on out there. And the popular retellings of the story involve some, in some capacity, I should say, a UFO element. So was that a counterintelligence aspect, or was there indeed something more and perhaps technological going on out there? We'll shift this conversation over as it pertains to a breakaway civilization in the next hour here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us.
Exopolitics.
It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenland Report with your host, Mike Evans.
And welcome back. We are descending now into the second hour of this week's edition of the program. So glad to have you with us as always. Here in mere moments, especially all of you history aficionados out there in the audience, you may just have your minds blown. Because we're going to be having one of the most interesting conversations about possible aerial technologies in the secret history of aviation that you will have ever had the opportunity to listen to. I know this for a fact because the gentleman who's going to be joining us here in mere moments, Walter Bosley, he is the author of a series of books that deal in part with this subject, but there's so much more. And as he was telling me just before we went to air, each of these books kind of has its own flair, its own character. So we'll be launching into that discussion with Walter here in mere moments. I want to remind you, of course, if you like what you hear on this program, you can find out a little bit more about what we do and even take things, as we like to say here in the heart of the Hollow Earth, a little beyond the bunker. All you have to do is sign up for Graylian X. It's at graylianreport.com/X, $7 a month. Same you'd spend on crappy fast food that you shouldn't be eating anyway. That's how we always like to say this. We've got your health in mind. So you might want to check out the subscriptions that we offer there, which gets you not only weekly additional podcasts, but also a lot more. In fact, what you will also get is monthly specials like Graylian Enigmas and the like. We've got a lot of stuff in store in the coming months with that in mind just as well. So do check that out at graylianreport.com/X. Now, without further ado, as I'd mentioned, we've got a very special guest on the program with us tonight. Walter was kind enough, by the way, as busy as he is. I know he's been traveling a lot. Later this month, he's going to be speaking at a conference that is themed around the secret space program. I'll get him to tell us more about that just as well. But with everything he's had going on, he was kind enough to join us here on this program tonight and in time for me to get him on before I head overseas. So without further ado, welcome to the program, Walter Bosley. How are you, sir?
Doing great, Micah. I appreciate being on. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, most certainly. I think the last time that we ever actually spoke was I was giving a short talk for a e-event that Kevin Smith was putting on. Great guy.
And yes.
That was, I think, the last time we actually got to speak, but I always hear your name come up in conversations with Greg Bishop, who's been on the show many times. It's high time we got you on here. And the most recent circumstance under which people kept saying you need to go and read Walter's books had been an article I did about 1800s airships. I've been fascinated with this subject for a long time, and people kept saying you need to check out Walter's book on this, which happens to be Empire of the Wheel, the second installment of that series of books, Friends from Sonora. So right before we get into that, I want to ask you, Walt, you know, what? Tell us a little about your background and what got you interested in this subject.
Well, I spent roughly 19 and a half years in national security, when you include my last gig as a background security investigator, doing investigations on the backgrounds of people who had applied for jobs that would require clearances. Those 19 and a half years were spread out between the FBI, the Air Force OSI, and then doing counterterrorism consulting for clients around the world. So I am a licensed private investigator in the state of California. So I'm an investigator by nature, and I stumbled upon the Empire of the Wheel mystery, as I call it. And I had done the first book with Rick Spence, and it was while continuing to pursue that mystery, which, by the way, I had no idea really connected to this airship mystery, except for one nagging little bit in a newspaper. When I jumped into the second book, lo and behold, there it was, the airship mystery, which, you know, anyone interested in the history of UFOs is aware of. And I was aware of it up to a certain extent. But I really learned a lot more about it once I found its connection to my San Bernardino mystery that I had been investigating already for a few years.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm like you, Walter. For a long time, I'd been interested in the airship accounts. But, you know, even the more open-minded Fortean researchers for years had said, these are probably cultural predecessors to UFOs. A lot of these things are probably, you know, newspaper hoaxes and things like this. But more and more over the last few years, as I've seen,
There is actually a history of aviation that I think it's always existed, but maybe people haven't had the access to it thanks to the reach of the World Wide Web, and now we're finding that there were a number of inventors. I mean, Solomon Andrews, going all the way back to the 1860s, had proposed an airship, the Ariane, I believe, for the Union Army, and so we see a lot of these. We'll get into a few of those here a little later, but before we jump really deeply into the airship thing, why don't you give us a bit of background first about the first installment of the Empire of the Wheel series, which dealt with ritualistic murders that may have been taking place in the Southwest, right?
Well, specifically in San Bernardino, California, which those of you familiar with the Inland Empire in Southern California, you might find it hard to believe, but at one point, for many years, San Bernardino was the garden spot for tourists in Southern California who came to Southern California. People from other countries, people from all over the U.S., if they came to Southern California, they came to San Bernardino. It had a huge park called Urbita Springs Park, which was actually the Disneyland of its day. It was so popular. While I was following up on research from my Disneyland book, which has to do with telluric current or ley lines, we call them colloquially, and I was looking for paranormal stories, ghost stories, that kind of thing, and I happened to find one connected with a mall out here in San Bernardino that actually stands where this Urbita Springs Park used to be. And a local librarian told me the story of a woman named Cora Stanton. Well, when I started looking closely at the Cora Stanton story, Ann Walker was the librarian's name, and she's the one that first told me, you know, hey, there's something funny going on here. The newspaper said it was a suicide, but I think there was foul play. So I went and looked at the newspaper reports, and what I saw not only was that I agreed with Ann, the librarian, regarding certain, you know, questionability about whether this was really a suicide with this woman, Cora Stanton, or not. I also found that within weeks or days of her mysterious death, there were six other victims, five other victims. One victim was a couple of months before. Well, one thing led to another. And yeah, I ended up with my co-author, Richard Spence, you know, putting together a book that presents this big mystery that may have involved a cult-driven sacrificial murder. It involves the espionage activity that was going on, because this was 1915. This was right in the middle of World War I, before the United States got involved. There were German agents, there were British agents all over California, and this mystery, you know, was smack dab in the middle of all that intrigue. And that's essentially what Empire of the Wheel 1 is about, is exploring, you know, who was this woman? Cora Stanton might not even been her name. Who were these other six victims? What's going on here? You know, and, you know, we ended up honestly with more questions asked than we could answer. And there was a little tidbit in a newspaper that led to the second book and the whole connection to the airship mystery.
Right, which I believe involves these so-called friends from Sonora. You want to tell us about that?
Yes. Well, that newspaper clipping, there was a young man, 24 years old, who in the middle of this mystery series of deaths in 1915, he was arrested on a train bound for Barstow. He was basically having a nervous breakdown. He said he was hallucinating the face of a woman. He said that there were these unnamed others who were persecuting him for attacking a woman. And he had in his possession a woman's purse with a couple of hundred bucks. And he was just, he was losing it. So he was arrested, taken to the county hospital, where he was pretty much diagnosed as being dangerously paranoid. However, in spite of the fact that there were these mysterious deaths, very possibly murders going on at this time that he was arrested, and in spite of his condition, in spite of all the circumstances, he's released by the hospital and the police into the custody of these unidentified friends from Sonora. That's all the newspaper account said. It said Frank Rosasco, that's his name, was released into the custody of friends from Sonora. Well, that had nagged me. as I said before, after doing the first book. And when I started the second book, it actually started out to be what the third book is. But what happened was, when I looked deeper into this Frank Rosasco, I discovered his connection was indeed to Sonora, California. And that, of course, opened up the possibility of a connection with the Sonora Aero Club.
Yeah. Now, for folks who aren't familiar with it, we actually did a show on this program a while back about that. But this story kind of comes to light years after the purported Aero Club in question. But, of course, it involves a man who is remembered as a graphic artist, but he claimed to be something a little more than that. Walter, why don't you give us a little bit of a background about that?
Well, Charles Delshow was an interesting character. He died in 1923, I believe, in his 90s. And in the late 1800s, he had begun to put together a journal that was both a written journal and mostly a visual journal. And what these were very colorful and detailed schematics, so to speak, of flying machines that he claimed were built in the 1850s in and around Sonora, California, Columbia, the Gold Country, Tuolumne County, up there just outside of the western entrance to Yosemite National Park. And Delshow, in his writings, claimed that this very secretive group of German immigrants, mostly German immigrants, there were a few Italians in there, they were building these what really amounted to anti-gravity flying machines in the 1850s.
Huh, yeah.
Now, I want to say this. Some people say, oh my gosh, he's saying anti-gravity. You know, some people are going to run out and say, Bosley says that there were stealth aircraft and B-2s and flying triangles in the 1850s, you know, anti-gravity Nazi flying saucers. No, that's not what I'm saying. Here's the way to look at this, what Delshow was claiming in his journals. The flying contraptions of the Sonora Aero Club of the 1850s, these would be like the Model T version for those, you know, who know something about automobile history. The Delshow Aeros, as they were called, A-E-R-O-S, these flying machines were very rudimentary, and they were pretty much like a Model T car. Now, then when you go, say, 40 years later into the airship mystery of the 1890s, those airships, a little more advanced, those would be like the, say, the 1950s Buick Roadmaster version of an anti-gravity craft, right? And then as you get into the 20th century, that's when you get into the development of the more modern, you know, and today we'd have the Ferrari of anti-gravity aircraft. So that's the line of development that I envision between Delshow and what we would have today.
Right. You know, it's interesting too, Walter, because specifically Delshow in his texts, which many dispute as having any significance beyond just being, watercolor renderings of fantastic imaginary craft, but he describes specifically that this group, this Aero Club in Sonora, had been utilizing something called NB gas, I believe, mm-hmm. a gas, and this is the way that they achieved this, what they called anti-gravitational lift. So it seems that what they were describing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems as if they were describing something very much like dirigible kind of craft, or maybe something a little different, but nonetheless powered heavier than aircraft, correct?
Well, yes and no. Here's what's interesting. Absolutely. On the surface, you think, well, you know, this Sonora Aero Club had, figured out, you know, dirigible technology. However, when you dig into the details and you really read the descriptions of these things, you realize that it wasn't quite dirigible technology. And what's even more interesting, when you look at the drawings that Delshow did in his journals, you find surprisingly that there appeared to have been the same technology as that known as the Bell.
Really?
Yes, this NB gas was formed by there was a liquid formula that included water and secret ingredients that the leader of the Sonora Aero Club had invented. And when you look at the mechanism, there is a rotating drum inside of a casing. And this liquid that had been invented would be dripped or poured over the rotating drum.
Hmm.
Well, in one of the drawings of the more developed aero devices, there's literally a what's called a generator cone for the power, the propulsion, and it is literally shaped like a bell, and it spins on an axis, and it also utilizes this secret serum, so to speak. Well, what does that sound like? If any of you have read about Igor Wachowski's or Joseph Farrell's work on the Nazi bell, you had the rotating element with the mysterious serum that, you know, would flow over the object or between the two counter-rotating elements. For all the world, what Delschau appears to be describing and illustrating, okay, is a rudimentary mid-19th century attempt at the same technology. And what makes it very intriguing is, what did we say before? This was a group of German immigrants, the Sonora Aero Club, and according to Delschau, they were developing these air machines in secret under the aegis, under the guiding hand of a mysterious group called NIMSA, which, as Delschau said, was based in Germany. So when you think about it, my personal conclusion, or I'll say suggestion,
sure,
at the moment, is that what we're looking at here was actually the early history of the development of this bell technology that would emerge again during the World War II era with the Nazis in the 20th century and is likely advanced, you know, and being used to this day.
You know, this is where this gets – I even wrote in my own book a few years ago, The UFO Singularity, that I had a strange hunch about these airships and that this – rather than being, you know, some fantastical retelling of the history of aviation, might be representative of technologies that were a few decades ahead of what everyone else knew to exist. I even think, Walter, from time to time about Nikola Tesla and his description of an aircraft. He had a brilliant description he gave of something that is remarkably similar to all this, whether or not that was ever put into effect, who knows. But the thing is, and I think actually you touch on that, by the way, about Tesla. I want to hand that over to you here in a moment, but again, the question I have is, how much would it take for someone, or several someones, to just have a revolutionary, a very different way of looking at physics, electromagnetism, and mechanics in a way that would be conducive to a sort of technology that is not beyond the capabilities of Earth, but merely inaccessible in terms of being something that has operated for a long time on the periphery of human civilization? I mean, is it crazy to ask that?
Oh, I don't think it is at all. And actually, what it takes for that to happen is simply for one person to try it and have success with their proof of concept. If they can demonstrate that it works, there you go. It works. And then from there, it's just developing it further. And I think that, you know, there's an argument that there's evidence that this has gone on for quite a long time in human history.
Yeah, I think there certainly is. Before we go to a break, I want to get to the discussion of this NIMSA group a little. There have been a lot of people, maybe even Pete Navarro, the Houston-based UFO researcher who spent decades looking at Delschau's art, and he had said that he believed that there was a coding, a narrative presented in the works, and that you had to really look carefully at the totality of what Delschau had written and presented. And he said that this group, NIMSA, that's N-Y-M-Z-A, some have speculated that that's an acronym, and I think that one popular interpretation of it is the New York Mechanical Zephyr Association. Now, I know in your book you have a very different interpretation of the meaning, which to me, it almost made my blood run cold the way that you described this. It was very interesting, the breakdown. Can you tell us a little bit about your own estimations about what NIMSA means?
Ah, yes, that was one of the things that kind of gave me chilly bumps on my skin, too, when I kind of looked at this closer and figured it out. Basically, NIMSA, Delschau spells it in all capital letters, N-Y-M-Z-A, which tends to suggest that we are talking about an acronym here. Delshow described it as a very mysterious organization. He also very specifically and clearly states that it is German-based. It is a German organization that is based in Germany. And that, of course, is further backed up by the fact that Delshow himself was a German immigrant sent here, it appears, by NIMSA to report on the Sonora Aero Club, a group of German immigrants playing with this technology. So I thought to myself, okay, I understand why, because there's a little confusion between the Sonora Aero Club, which is 1850s, and the 1890s airship mystery, where it talks about East Coast investors in the airship mystery, the 1890s. Well, a lot of people assume that that applied to the NIMSA. And because of the NY, they assume, well, that must be New York, right? Because these East Coast inventors, NY must be New York. And there is a New York connection to all of this. However, with Delshow saying it was a German-based outfit, I looked at it from that perspective. And I said to myself, well, there's got to be a German translation for this. And when I look closer, I found one. And it fit very well, not just with the letters of the acronym, but with the whole milieu of what we're talking about.
Right. Now, granted, we want people to read the book, of course. So I'll ask you before I ask you, is that something mm-hmm. that you can describe for us here on the program?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, because there's so much to the book that I look at this, you know, as just something that would draw people to want to learn more about it. But basically, I translated NIMSA, NYMZA, as a transliteration mm-hmm. that Delshow was doing of a German organization that the actual acronym would have been NJMZA. Mm-hmm. And I translated that with the help of some German native speakers to be the Nationalistische Jagdflugzeug Maschinen Zahlungsamt. Now, essentially, that roughly translates to the Nationalist Pursuit Aircraft Development Office.
Right.
The literal translation is the Nationalist Hunting Flying Thing Machines Payment Office. But it would be the Nationalist, not national, and that's an important distinction, because in the 1850s, there was no unified Germany as we've known it. There were a bunch of Prussian principalities and such, and some of them were nationalists who were pushing towards German unification. And having such an organization with technology would have served – with this technology would have served their purposes perfectly. So I attach this – the reason I use nationalist is I attach this to that early Prussian interest for a unified Germany. And through an organization like NIMSA, they would have exercised their the possession of superior technologies and such. You know, just an age-old political move to show strength when needed. And it really was instrumental in leading to the, you know, unified Germany and to the Nazis in the 20th century.
But this is, of course, a little more than just a political movement we're talking about here. I mean, we're talking about an organization that probably operates more, if not less, as a secret outfit. I mean, working...
Right.
We're talking about literally a secret society that is controlling from behind the scenes.
Yes.
And, of course, there is historical precedent for this. But, I mean, what are the implications that we're looking at here, Walter, of a nationalist, you know, Prussian-German organization operating partially in the United States with some sort of an ulterior objective? What exactly are we looking at? What are the implications?
Well, here's what's interesting. When you get into Empire of the Wheel 3, I then go deeper into this mysterious NIMSA, and I do reveal what I found and what to me the evidence suggests is a very secret hand behind the Prussian-German NIMSA of the 19th century. And it suggests that there is and has been this secret hand, this secret organization that ties back to ancient times. And they would have been the source of some of this technological knowledge. In other words, this unknown entity was manipulating Prussia, the Prussian states at that time, to push towards a German unification to serve their goals and agenda.
I tell you, it's fascinating stuff. Walter, when we come back from this break, what I want to get into with you a little bit, I want to discuss the need or the reason maybe behind apparent secrecy that might be utilized. This is a question people often have. If these people are operating, if they're all powerful, if not all powerful, at very least for that period in history, they were capable of a lot more than most, then why would they operate in secret? That's going to be a question we'll address when we come back with Walter Bosley here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. We'll return in just a moment. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Welcome back as we're continuing our discussion with author and researcher Walter Bosley. The subject tonight, of course, the Empire of the Wheel. And this is indeed an enigmatic mystery that is unfolding, and lo and behold, even to the surprise of the author in question, do we not find that this perplexing story about airships in the 1800s comes to light once again. I'm so glad that Walter's able to join us tonight. Now, picking up from where we left off in the last segment, Walter, I wanted to ask you, if indeed we're dealing with a secret operation, perhaps one of German origin, a nationalist organization with this motivation that perhaps exists or extends, I should say, beyond into the periphery of human operations and the kinds of motivations that would drive most, what exactly is the purpose of secrecy? Why would these operations be carried out in secrecy? And more importantly, what was this group attempting to try and achieve?
Well, I think the advantages of secrecy actually are kind of obvious when you stop and think about it. You can accomplish more influence on those you wish to influence doing it out of the limelight. Particularly if you are seeking to influence those who seek the limelight or are already there. And it's very Machiavellian, actually, yeah. By playing upon their egos, having, those who will be your face believe that they are part of something special. They are serving, a larger purpose. They're easier to manipulate. So the secret hand behind this, has all sorts of things to gain by doing it secretly. Now, why they're secret in the first place, that could be a variety of reasons. It could just simply be that their reputations are such that if they were to do this openly, they would be stopped or resisted. Or perhaps they don't want the general public to know about the resources that they actually do possess. It could be, as simple as that. It could be, when you're talking about nationalist interests, it could be a security issue. The German NIMSA, as I've translated it, perhaps simply just wanted this to be, their secret weapon, so to speak, or their, the ace in their sleeve kind of thing. Variety of reasons for secrecy, and it could be any or all of them, but one that is suggested, as I said in my subsequent research, is that the hand behind the overarching organization behind NIMSA could be something that is historically unacceptable to most people or unknown, and that's what I refer to when I said it went back to possibly ancient times, that there just may be and have been a hidden civilization or the remnant of a lost civilization that survived, you know, its downfall, and yet they've had this technology or developed said technology, and they have designs to influence the world we live in, to have a hand in how things happen. It could very well be that.
You know, I guess this qualifies by definition as being quote-unquote a conspiracy theory. Now, granted, we all know that there is historical precedent for these kind of things unfolding. I have to wonder if in modern politics, if really everything that we see is as it appears to be. Because I'm often told by friends of mine, you know, who have worked not only in politics, but who have worked in the media and who have worked very closely with politicians, as well as, of course, the lobbyists up on K Street. And they'll tell you all kinds of interesting stories about the way that things unfold on television, for instance, you know, on C-SPAN or on, you know, any of the 24-hour news cycle stations, versus the way things actually take place in offices the night before a vote before Congress. Now, I know this sounds incredibly conspiratorial for people, but if you follow me, the idea is everything that you observe in the world, the orchestration of votes and the influence of the constituency upon those who are elected officials who are elected to represent them. And I don't think that anyone in the modern era really thinks that that is how things go. And when we come back around to what you just said, Walter, a Machiavellian kind of interpretation of all this, you know, the concept of the means that justify the ends, you know, I don't think that we can be so naive as to think that everything that we see in the waking world is as it appears to be. There are obviously subversive influences. And historian Carol Quigley even talked about this. I think Joe Farrell actually mentioned this in one of his books. Talked about his actual experiences with a control group of sorts and an organization that working behind the scenes absolutely influenced geopolitical affairs. So, you know, it's not that far beyond the stretch of the imagination to assume that this has been going on for much longer and that some of these organizations, whatever name they operate under, or whichever we, you know, attempt to assign to them today, that they may have been doing these kind of things as far back as the 1850s, and that there was a technological component to it just as well. In the book, Walter, The Empire of the Wheel, Two Friends from Sonora, and people, if you're interested in this, you've got to check this book out. It really is a good read. You get into some very interesting areas with this, which include not only attempts at trying to understand what the airship operation specifically was doing, how this related to South America, but also Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid come up in this narrative just as well. That really took me by surprise. How does all that fit into this?
Wow, I'll tell you, it took me by as much surprise as it did you. Wow. How that fit in, how that emerged, how they emerged, was my further attempt to identify the mysterious Cora Stanton. Now, in the first book, Rick and I conclude that Cora Stanton was not likely the real name of the woman found drowned to death floating in the lake in Urbita Springs Park on November 19th, 1915. That has to do with, and the details are all in the book, but that has to do with the fact that the alleged suicide note was found like almost 2 weeks after her body was found. And it was found in a spot that had already been searched by the police. So this suggests that her suicide note was planted there. And due to all the other esoterica that is deeply entrenched in that whole case, which the book goes into, due to all that esoterica, there's more reason to suggest that Cora Stanton was not a real name. So who was she? Well, what's interesting is because of another figure who I was possibly identifying with a missing person of the time, I was looking at a lot of historical missing persons lists, okay? Mm-hmm. And a name popped up when I was looking at the list that I never realized that this woman was technically considered, you know, one of these historical missing persons where what happened to her was unknown. And when I looked at her physical description, the only physical description available of her, I just, again, the goosebumps, you know, I thought, wait a minute, the hair color, the eye color are just too close, the height, the weight, the build, oh boy, you know, what have I got here? And that woman, and I've talked about this elsewhere, so I'm not going to try to hold it as a secret. And, you know, this is another tidbit to draw people to the book.
Sure.
But I came to the conclusion that Cora Stanton, the mysterious Cora Stanton, was actually at a place, the woman who is more known as the alleged girlfriend wife of the Sundance Kid, friend of Butch Cassidy.
Huh. Now, why do you say alleged, by the way?
Well, because when you look at what's available on Etta Place, what's available on Butch Cassidy and Sundance and Etta, you find that most of the conclusions that people have drawn about who Etta Place was, about who even Sundance was, are really based on speculation and opinion of the Pinkerton guys in most cases. Mm-hmm. And when you read the original source material, you realize that this was speculation because they just didn't quite know. You know, they didn't know this. They didn't know that. They didn't know where she was from. Based on the fact that they saw her with them, they assumed, oh, you know, that must be their, you know, must be his girlfriend, or he must have married her, that kind of thing. But it's astonishing when after, you know, over a century of books and movies, and the assumptions that have been made about that situation and those people, it's astonishing when you go back and look at the original source material and you realize how much of it is just pure opinion, pure assumption, pure speculation. And the truth is something that, you know, no one would have expected. You see, the woman, Cora Stanton, when she was found dead, the medical examiner, they guessed she was in her mid-30s, uh-huh. She was definitely a virgin.
Hmm.
Now, a 35-year-old virgin, and when you read the first book, Empire of the Wheel, you see that the Episcopal Church, the local Episcopal Church, plays a very important role in all this. You know, my thought was, wow, Cora Stanton might have been a nun.
Yeah.
Why do I say that? Because she's supposedly a suicide, but the local Episcopal minister gives her a very public funeral. Thousands of people, hundreds of people were actually invited to it. Thousands of people, you know, were gathered around. This made the news, and what you have to understand about 1915, the Episcopal Church was very, what they call high church, old church, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And I talked to ecclesiastical experts, and they told me under, you know, don't be, that absolutely, under no circumstances would the Episcopal Church have allowed such a public funeral to be given to a suicide. It just was not done. So what does that suggest? As I say in the book and I go into detail, it suggests that someone at the Episcopal Church knew who Cora Stanton really was, what she really was, and it suggests that they knew she was not a suicide.
I'll tell you this, Walter, that my father's an Episcopal minister, and I have served as an altar boy during many what are known as Rite One, old-style Anglican masses. And I'll tell you this. There's an interesting history about the church that my father is presently still the rector of. It's called Church of the Redeemer here in Asheville, actually just outside the city limits in a little township called Woodfin. But it's an old stone church built in the 1880s. And there is a Tiffany window in the church, an actual Louis Tiffany work of stained glass, and it commemorates fallen soldiers of World War One. But the reason for the story here and how it ties in with what you're talking about is it specifically was put in place because of a young man who actually died. He fell in the First World War, who had been a member of the parish. His lover, who would have been his wife had he returned, is presumed to have, and this actually is not a presumption, I know a gentleman who, very elderly now, but at the time, a young man actually assisted in pulling the young woman's body out of the river, the French Broad River, when she committed suicide. Just as you said, because of the suicide connected with this, there was no public funeral. So absolutely, in keeping with that period in time, what you're talking about seems very consistent, very likely, in fact. And it's incredible. And yet this was, I mean, you said that there were hundreds, more than that, in fact, who attended this funeral. I mean, absolutely, this was a person of significance, at least to that church.
Yes, the book goes into the connection that the Episcopal Church nationally in the United States had to the intelligence community. I mean, dating back, you know, almost since the beginning of the nation. And so there you have intelligence activities. You have spies, correct? Now, the book goes into why I think that this woman identified as Cora Stanton, who I'm convinced was at the place, would have been involved in all this. But that's why I argue that Etta Place was neither Sundance's lover or his wife. And the history of the possibility of her being a nun with the Episcopal Church ties her to the Texas brothel where she would have met Butch and Sundance. And it explains what my theory is on what their whole connection was and what that whole thing was about.
Folks at home, by the way, strange though that may sound, what Walter just said, it's very well explained in the book. And that book is The Empire of the Wheel, Two Friends from Sonora. But there are three of those, and there'll be more books to follow just as well, whether or not they pertain to this particular subject. But I want to ask you something more fundamental here, Walter. What precisely leads us to the title, The Empire of the Wheel? I mean, is this part of a broader-reaching operation, conspiracy, secret society? What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, yes, there is looming behind all this, and the third book, I think, gets into that a lot more. There is looming behind all this, unfortunately, I think, a larger, darker picture going on. But specifically, because the San Bernardino Valley for the longest time was the heart of what we call the Inland Empire, and because smack dab in the middle of all this occult and esoteric intrigue is the goddess Hecate, whose symbol is the wheel, we decided to refer to the location and the series of books. It's really just a trilogy of books. As Empire of the Wheel, because we considered that the Inland Empire, to the degree of those involved with this mystery, were doing this in a very dark veneration to the goddess Hecate, again, whose symbol is the wheel, therefore Empire of the Wheel.
You know, this reminds me of something. The old candle of recognition is flickering in the back of the brain here. Walter, there's a case, a really strange one, that involves an island purported to exist off the coast of Chile. And back in around 1984, people were allegedly contacted by the inhabitants of this island. They were described by the local Chileans as being gringos, but these gringos actually more, to use more descriptive terms, they were described specifically as Germans in other accounts, that operated on this island, purportedly had incredible technology, and that they kept away from the goings-on of most of humanity, but they would engage themselves with, for instance, smugglers who could bring them various different kinds of supplies and equipment that they needed out there. And their island was called Friendship, Isla Friendship. And so the story of the Friendship, of course, there's a ufological connection that goes all the way back to the 1950s and 60s that occurred in Italy. But this secondary version of the Friendship thing, many have dismissed it and said there is no Friendship Island, nothing's going on. Scott Corrales of the Institute of Hispanic Ufology has a brilliant series of articles at his Inexplicata blog about this. But what's interesting is that in a series of correspondences sent to him about the secret happenings going on, the technological operation, whatever it may have been, advanced as it was recognized as being, happening out there on Friendship Island throughout the 1980s, it's said that there was a peculiar religion that was associated with it. And when you mentioned this connection with this goddess and people who are observing whatever it is, this religious significance that she holds, specifically in this article that was posted at the Inexplicata blog by Scott Corrales, he talks about a researcher, Antonio Bellacanto, 35 years old, and he specifically says that there was an Area 51-like operation going on out there, according to his research, on this island. This was a group of people, probably the U.S. government, but strangely that there was some weird religion connected with it. And he said, I won't say anything else about this, but the information about this, he said, you won't find in libraries or anywhere online. Now, my first question, are you familiar with the Friendship case? And second of all, do you recognize any of these kinds of little cases that pop up over the years as the possible continuation of the kind of thing you're discovering, which may point to a breakaway civilization, to use a term that Richard Dolan and others have employed?
Wow. I have never heard of that. Giving me something to dig into, because the second part of that is, yes, I find that intriguing enough to want to learn more about it, to see what resonates. There could be you know, something in common with what I'm finding, what I've written about, with whatever the nugget of truth is with that story. We have to acknowledge it could be made up, but boy, it sure sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It certainly does. This is why I wanted to talk to you, and we'll have to catch up sometime, maybe off the microphone, and compare some notes just as well. But I mean, just to give people a kind of a background, in 1984, very briefly, the story involved, on the southern coast of Chile, a mysterious distress signal that buzzed across the receiver of a ham radio operator named Octavio Ortiz. And he was a business agent who operated a little 27 megacycle CB radio station in his pastime. But there was all of this story, all this hubbub about a ship called the Mitalus 2, and that people were receiving and sending these strange messages. Now, Scott Corrales, of course, ranks this among the most perplexing and strange cases in ufological history appended to Latin America. And he says, of course, the Friendship case has been a mixture of encounters, audio recordings, and sightings. Some interpret this as being largely human. Some claim it has belonged to everything from an island, supposedly, that had an alien base. Many actually discount that. More likely, they say that there's possibly a Nazi survivalist encampment of some sort, possibly Protestant missionaries from North America, all kinds of different interpretations of this case. But, again, it reminds me so much of what you've written about. And so when it comes around to this breakaway civilization concept, we'll talk more about that at a later time, but I want to ask you, we look at the UFO phenomena in the broader sense. By definition, in the 1850s, airships that were seen over the southwestern Americas would have been unidentified flying objects, not to say that there wasn't a plausible technology behind them. Could it be that throughout the last several decades, some of what we have called the extremely exotic in appearance technologies that we call ufological in nature, could these be the continuation of this very sort of technology that you describe in the Empire of the Wheel series?
Oh, absolutely. I have long been of the position that really, when you look at all UFO cases, I would venture to say that only 10% would be of the extraterrestrial variety. I think 90% of, and I'm just putting a number to it to make a point, I think that 90% of what people have been seeing and been reporting has been very much Earth-based technology, human-developed technology that's been done in secret for a variety of reasons, be it military stuff, you know, that's only need to know, or now, of course, you know, the concept of the breakaway or hidden civilization. But to answer your question, yes, I think 9 out of 10 times that's what you're looking at.
I agree with you, in fact, and that's been a rather about face for me. You know, I think many of us as researchers come into this thinking, okay, UFOs. Many never think beyond, okay, UFO equals alien. To me, less and less the evidence seems to suggest that that's what we're dealing with. More and more I'm seeing this as being something that is indeed a technology that could be from right here on Earth. And as time goes on, the evidences of it that have emerged over the decades, centuries perhaps, are emerging. Now, before we let you go, I know that your time is very valuable. You're a busy guy, and I appreciate you again coming on the show, Walter. I do want to talk a little bit about what you've got coming up, which includes, if I recall correctly, a secret space program conference in Bastrop, Texas, toward the end of the month, right?
Yes, I do. And what's interesting about that location, when they first told me it was going to be in Bastrop, Bastrop is one of the many towns in Texas. When you go back to the 1890s airship mystery, the newspaper in Bastrop reported witnesses seeing these airships. So the Secret Space Program Breakaway Civilization Conference for 2015 is going to be in the heart of airship country in Bastrop, Texas, just a little south of Austin, on the weekend of October 31st and November 1st, a perfect time, of course, Halloween weekend. And I'll be down there with Joseph Farrell, Catherine Austin Fitz, Paula Violette, Brandenburg. I forget his first name.
I've probably got it here somewhere. But
yeah. And talking about, you know, his Mars theories and great stuff. And Jay Dyer and Olaf Phillips. I mean, we're going to have a really good collection of speakers on this this whole concept of this secret space program technology and breakaway civilization issue. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's the first time I attended last year in San Mateo. This is my first year speaking at it, and I'll be speaking on the NIMSA and this 19th century origin of the 20th and 21st century breakaway civilization.
Fabulous. I tell you, if possible, my schedule is pretty tight, but I already told you in private correspondence, I hope to try and get down that way. Not sure if it's going to happen. I've got a lot of travel coming up over the next couple of weeks. If I can, love to sit down with you, have a cup of coffee, and compare some notes. Walter Bosley. I know you, or Bosley, I apologize, but now you've got another book you're working on, but as far as what's been published and what's available right now, what is your latest book that people can look for just as well?
Real quick, I want to say, if you can't attend in Texas, they are live streaming it.
Oh.
So you can get a live stream ticket and view it on the internet. My most recent book that came out in July was the second of my new series, Secret Missions, and it is The Lost Expedition of Sir Richard Francis Burton. In a nutshell, I stumbled upon the little talked about fact in all the Burton biographies that there were a few missing months during his time in South America. When I say missing, Burton was a man who wrote prolifically about everything he did, except for this period of 4 to 6 months in South America, in which he was wandering the South American wilderness in the 1860s, and he didn't say a word. Well, when you think about what's down there, Machu Picchu, Pumapunku, and all that strange stuff, it's kind of interesting. And I delved into that, and that's what the most recent book is about. It is, as I said, the second in my Secret Mission series. The first one is about the mystery of Juan Cabrillo, who he really was, what he might have really been doing. And that has to do with ancient lost technology, as does the Burton book. So I think those who really like where I went with Empire of the Wheel, those three books, Secret Missions is a little bit of a different track, but it does, you know, kind of have its thread to this idea of a hidden hand and a hidden technology.
Well, I'll tell you, fascinating stuff. Walter, I want to thank you again for coming on the program. We will do it again really soon when both of us have a little more time. We may have to do a full 2 hours because there's so much we could be talking about. And again, if it works out that I can be in Texas later this month, I'll try to make it down that way. Otherwise, we will certainly be in touch, and we will have you back here again in the future on the Graylian Report.
Thanks again, Mike. I really appreciate being here.
It's been our pleasure. All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Again, that's Walter Bosley, and do check out his website. You can find out more at www.empireofthewheel.blogspot.com. That's where you can find information about Walter and his ongoing work. We haven't got a whole lot of time here, but we're going to take one very, very short break. And when we return, I guess we'll look at what might be the concluding thoughts. Final thoughts on the broader concept that we spent the entire last 2 hours discussing here. The implications of some of this. It is strange indeed what we are looking at. Maybe a lot more questions than answers, really. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll talk about that more when we return here on the Graylian Report. Welcome back. As we're wrapping things up tonight, again, a few final thoughts. We've got to be very brief before the clock catches us here. I'm so glad that Walter was able to join us tonight on the program. Some of my own research, and toward the end of the last hour, we were talking about this friendship case, and this is, as you've heard on the air tonight, the reason that researchers like Walter and I get together and talk, whether it be in front of a live audience or, you know, in a coffee shop someplace. There is so much to this mystery and so much to be unraveled, I think. And there are often, as we find over the course of our investigations, there's a lot more in terms of actual questions that emerge than perhaps the answers that we seek, which makes it all the more important that we keep an open mind, but that we are discerning and skeptical in our approach and that we try to find the answers. When it comes to the broader notion of the phenomena that we call ufology, I have long looked at this and wondered exactly, what are we dealing with? I can't tell you I have an answer. But the more time I spend researching, studying, probing for details, communicating with people, traveling, studying, learning, the more the obvious things that were often left at the edifice, so to speak, make their way closer and closer to the light, and the shadows, once long and dark, grow shorter and shorter and shorter. But the phenomena that we observe in the meantime, as it appears closer and closer, and the brightness before us is very much different from what we expected. That will be the last word for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, and as always, you are welcome to email me, info@graylianreport.com, as well as info@micahhanks.com. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Jeremy London, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Grayson Robin Hobbs, Tyler Pittman, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, I remain your humble host here on this program. Headed off to London. Wish me luck, and we'll catch you guys again next week here on the Graylian Report. Stay strange, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.